From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Afghanistan, should we stay or should we go? Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Today's meeting between Presidents Obama and Karzai was billed as crucial to mapping the end of America's longest war. Less than a year ago, the U.S. and NATO promised continued assistance and training for 10 more years, with the Pentagon talking of 6,000 to 9,000 soldiers. Then the White House said a zero-troop option was on the table. Could drones and limited special forces prevent the country's collapse? We'll hear from the two presidents today, as well as different predictions about Afghanistan's future. On Reporter's Notebook, later on, movies, video games, and gun violence. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. At the Pentagon yesterday, Afghanistan's President Karzai said he hoped the U.S. would make sure his country would not ever again be threatened by terrorists. But many factors have reduced his clout in Washington and with the American people. We'll hear what he and President Obama had to say after today's White House luncheon. On Reporter's Notebook, the NRA blames popular culture for incidents like the Sandy Hook massacre, and Vice President Biden's been meeting with the film and video game industries. Are they part of the problem or an easy scapegoat? First, this news update. A battery fire broke out this week in a Boeing 787 Dreamliner parked at Logan Airport in Boston, the latest in a series of incidents that led the FAA to announce today it is launching a full-scale safety review. Dominic Gates is aerospace reporter for the Seattle Times. Good to have you on our program.
My pleasure, Warren.
I gather that it's the electrical system that seems to be the major problem here, and that there have been difficulties in flight. Tell us about them.
There have been a series of incidents stretching back to last summer involving the electrical systems, and at least two of those involved planes in flight. A United jet that was flying from Houston to Newark had to divert to New Orleans. And then a delivery flight for a Qatar Airways plane that was flying from Everett to Doha in Qatar that also had a similar problem. Now, this problem didn't put any passengers at risk. It just was an electrical fault that showed up in the cockpit and told the pilot that one of the generators seemed to be down, and so they diverted to be cautious. However, there was this series of incidents. There were four of those incidents which have now been traced to bad circuit boards in an electrical power distribution panel. But then this incident on Monday was much more serious, and that really caught people's attention, and I think that's why what happened today was announced.
What about it was more serious than the previous incidents?
Because it was a fire on an airplane. A fire on an airplane is an incredibly serious thing to happen. Now, it happened on the ground, and, of course, all the passengers had disembarked. There were 193 passengers and crew aboard. They had all left the plane, and the fire started in a battery in the electronics bay underneath the rear fuselage when a mechanic was on board doing some maintenance. He noticed smoke. So in that particular instance, there wasn't danger, but that plane had landed less than half an hour before, and it had flown for 12 hours and 20 minutes from Tokyo. So when you then get a fire breaking out immediately afterwards, it certainly raises a question. And the NTSB is investigating it. They haven't come up with the cause of it yet. But, of course, Boeing and everyone else hopes that the cause of it was something that happens on the ground. This battery is used to start something called the auxiliary power unit, used to provide power when the plane is on the ground, when the main engines are running. And so hopefully it was something that would only happen on the ground. But for the moment, they're still investigating. And when you get something as serious as that, I mean, a fire in flight would be catastrophic.
You were saying that Boeing hopes, as it do others, that this couldn't happen in flight. I think Boeing has been fairly insistent, has it not, that in fact this could not happen in flight?
They have been. The senior vice president who's been in charge of the electrical systems on the 787 since the inception for the last decade, Mike Sinnott, he gave me an interview during the week, and he laid out in very great detail the various features that they have built into the system, multiple redundancies and protections. And basically his contention was that even if that battery had caught fire in flight, that it would not have presented, it wouldn't have brought the plane down because they've designed it to contain a small fire like that, and the smoke would have vented outside. However, his assurances were technically very, very competent and did reassure the markets, and Boeing's stock price recovered. But there was still, because of all the television coverage, I think, a great deal of public concern. And I think what we've got today is the FAA acting to try and reassure the public. Because what they said on this press conference this morning as they announced this review was that they believe the plane is safe.
Have they indicated that they might ground the plane under any circumstances?
No, certainly not. I mean, what options were open to the FAA? They could have done nothing. They could have grounded the plane. Those were the two extremes. But grounding the plane would have destroyed this program, potentially. They didn't feel that was necessary at all. What they're saying is, we believe this plane is safe. And so they're saying that the plane will continue to fly. There are 50 planes in service right now. It takes off about 150 times every day. And they're going to continue to do so. And the government is saying, we think it's safe. However, to be cautious and to reassure people, we're going to check it all out. Now, this is short-term, I think, going to be problematic for Boeing. It's going to take some engineering resources, and perhaps it will shake some people's confidence who never even thought about it before. But in the end, if the review comes out and says we think they've got it in control, it's probably better. It will. This rash of incidents required some kind of response. But again, I'd like to emphasize, none of those incidents in flight ever put any passengers at risk.
Understand. Very quickly, there are 50 in service now. Are there more to come?
There are 800 more to come.
Okay, that's what I thought. A big program. Again, Boeing's 787 Dreamliner now being examined by the FAA, but not, I think it's very important to point out, grounded. Dominic Gates, aerospace reporter for the Seattle Times, thanks a lot for being on our program.
You're welcome. Bye.
In a moment, Afghanistan. Should we stay or should we go? On To The Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai met yesterday with Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Today, he lunched with the president at the White House, and afterward, they spoke to reporters. The president had this to say.
Starting this spring, our troops will have a different mission: training, advising, assisting Afghan forces. It will be a historic moment and another step toward full Afghan sovereignty, something I know that President Karzai cares deeply about, as do the Afghan people.
James Kitfield is senior correspondent for the National Journal. He's been covering these stories for a very long time. Good to have you on our program.
Happy to be here.
How new is what we heard today from the president and from President Karzai?
Well, it's nothing we heard today was absolutely new. What you saw were two presidents who are looking at the end game for this longest in our history conflict, of which they're both so involved in, and speaking to their domestic constituencies. So there you had President Obama definitely sending the message that, you know, we are on the glide path out of this war. Whatever residual force we leave behind will have a very limited footprint and a very limited mission, something he knows plays very well in a war-weary America. And President Karzai saying, we are regaining Afghan sovereignty. We are regaining, you know, responsibility for our own country. The Americans are pulling back from the villages and the places where their presence is controversial. And we are sort of reestablishing, you know, a relationship between two normal countries. So both of them playing to their domestic constituencies. The only caveat I would add to that is this is the same dynamic that we saw with Iraq, where both sides ended up playing to their domestic constituencies to the point where a deal for residual force became impossible because it didn't allow them space to actually compromise on what that force would look like and under what authorities it would act.
One of the issues that held them up with regard to Iraq had to do with who would have jurisdiction over American troops in the event that there were untoward incidents or potential crimes. Is that one that's also been a problem with President Karzai?
It has been a sticking point, but I mean, in this press conference, actually, that was a bit new because this is clearly an American red line. We've never, in any place we've had status of forces agreements, allowed our soldiers to fall under local jurisdictions for their own safety and concerns that that would be abused by a local politician that might want to play to his domestic constituency. So we've never done that. We won't do that. It's a clear red line. President Obama said in the press conference there will be no follow-on American force in Afghanistan if they are not immune from local prosecution. President Karzai basically said, you've given on the subject of detainees. That is now we've sort of agreed to hand over all the Afghan detainees to Afghan authorities. We've given on some of these night raids where we're now saying that the Afghans are in the lead on those and we need permission to launch those. And having said that, he said, I can take this argument to the Afghan people and, suggesting that he's willing to give a bit on that red line.
Did we get any indication from the Pentagon or from the State Department as to what number of troops might be left in Afghanistan after the drawdown and at the end of 2014?
No, that's still the $64 million question. I mean, there's two questions outstanding, one of which is how fast we pull the remaining 65,000 troops out between now and the end of 2014 when the combat mission is totally over. And the other one is what sort of residual force. The president said he knows, he has a better idea of what the goals of that force would be, having talked to President Karzai, but he hasn't heard from his generals yet. And once he does that, he'll decide on the issue of the glide path between now and 2014, probably within the next couple of months. And on the issue of residual force, the White House has said this week they expect an agreement to be reached by latest November this year.
So not much new then, even though President Karzai has spent the last couple of days at the Pentagon and at the State Department and now at the White House today. What do you think he accomplished?
I think he accomplished what he really wanted was sort of indications that America is this relationship is enduring beyond 2014, that there will be resources and help from the Americans going forward, and that there wouldn't be sort of a rush for the exits, both physically as well as figuratively. And I think he got some assurances there. He has a whole wish list of equipment he wants NATO and U.S. to leave behind. We don't know what he got there, but it's clear that they're going to need a lot of equipment. There is no sort of operative Afghan Air Force. Their forces are still very dependent on us for logistics, for air power, for medevac of wounded soldiers, for command and control, for these drone-type surveillance platforms. So those are the details that will have to be ironed out when we decide what kind of residual force. If you talk about a force that's below, say, 6,000, you can forget most of those enabling missions because you just can't supply that kind of heavy lift with those small numbers. That would signal that the recurring mission in Afghanistan for residual force will just be counterterrorism strikes. Hard to see how the Afghan forces are going to stand on their own without those enablers. So the numbers are important, but we got no signal from what the numbers are actually going to be after 2014.
Okay. James Kedfield again, senior correspondent for the National Journal. Thanks very much for being on our program.
Happy to do it.
During the news conference, I should say, the president was asked the very question we have just discussed. What about the residual troops, as they're being referred to, meaning those that are left after the drawdown at the end of 2014? And here's what he said.
I can't give you a precise number at this point. I'll probably make a separate announcement once I've gotten recommendations from troops, from the generals and our commanders in terms of what that drawdown might look like.
General David Barno is retired Army three-star general. He was commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan from 2003 until 2005. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. General, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Recently, it has been revealed, and you have written about this, that the number of American troops might, in fact, be zero. And the White House has said that that is an option that is on the table. What would that mean, and why is the White House now considering what sounds like a very different number from what they were talking about as recently as last May, when the Pentagon was saying, and I think still is saying, 6,000, 8,000, something like that?
I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One of which that shouldn't be discounted is the fact that having that option out there on the table in advance of President Karzai's visit created a little bit of leverage for the United States in our discussions with Karzai this week, making it clear to him that we weren't encumbered by some absolute strategic imperative to keep, you know, thousands of American forces in Afghanistan forevermore. I think there was a perception, I've seen evidence that this is probably accurate, that President Karzai came here with an absolute belief that the United States had to keep troops in Afghanistan post-2014 for our own strategic interest, to put pressure on Iran next door to the west, to keep some kind of a grip on the Pakistanis to the east, to be able to do counter-terrorist strikes, and that Afghanistan actually was central to all that. There was no way to defend those large, vital strategic interests in the United States other than having American troops there. And I think part of the discussion on Zero was to make the point to Karzai that that's still an option. The president's looking at a full range of options, from no forces and accomplishing some of those tasks I just described in other ways to, you know, something upwards of 10,000 or more troops in Afghanistan.
Well, now, what would the zero option mean? Would that mean that the United States would then deal with its own interests in those other areas you mentioned with the drones and special forces on special missions, or something of that kind?
Well, I think it would indicate that there wouldn't be an American combat troops in Afghanistan, troops even supporting the Afghans as advisors or counterterrorist forces there, and that we would accomplish those missions if we did them at all in other ways. So in terms of counterterrorism, we might be looking for just access to bases periodically instead of actually having troops stationed there to do some of these raid missions in that part of the world. It might certainly imply that we'd have a deeper investment in the drone program that obviously is pretty active right now. It also, I think, would absolutely reinforce the importance of our intelligence networks out there in that part of the world, which are separate from our military forces, and are something that I think are going to continue in Afghanistan and the region to be a major U.S. investment, regardless of what we do on the military side.
What do you think is the likelihood, General, that we will go to the zero option? Is it a real possibility, or was it, as you indicated earlier, designed to create some leverage and to suggest to President Karzai that we don't need him all that much?
I don't think we can rule it out, and I think that's important to recognize. You know, this wasn't simply a bluff. It's also a viable possibility. I mean, very few folks in the U.S. military had any inkling that we would have zero American military forces in Iraq after 2011, despite the fact that when President George W. Bush was in office, that was actually the agreement we reached with the Iraqis, no follow-on American presence. We had to negotiate out of that, which we failed to do. The Iraqis, as we heard earlier from Jim, failed to agree to an immunity agreement for American troops. If that were to happen in Afghanistan, President Obama was very clear in his press conference today that that would also be a war stopper for us. It would potentially end any possibility of American military presence in Afghanistan after 2014. So, again, under those conditions, it's a very real option. I think that that was an important message that I suspect President Karzai got this week.
David Barno, again, a retired Army three-star general, a former commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Here's another comment that the president made today. He said that the mission of preventing Afghanistan from becoming a haven for al-Qaeda, which might then attack the United States or attack its interests in various places. He also added this.
We pushed the Taliban out of their strongholds. Today, most major cities and most Afghans are more secure, and insurgents have continued to lose territory. Meanwhile, Afghan forces continue to grow stronger.
Alyssa Rubin is the Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times. She joins us from there. And Alyssa Rubin, it's always good to have you on our program. Many thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The president said today, most major cities and most Afghans are more secure, and insurgents have continued to lose territory. How worried are people in the cities of Afghanistan and in the countryside as well about what might happen if, in fact, the American force dwindles not just to 6,000 or 9,000, but perhaps even to zero?
I think there are very serious worries here, in fact, especially in the cities where people have probably seen the most changes in their lives because, you know, there's much more electricity, there's a variety of amenities, schools, and I think particularly in the large cities, there's a lot of anxiety about what is going to happen next. I think the situation in the countryside where the war has largely been fought in rural areas like Helmand and in Kandahar, there's much more mixed feelings about a U.S. withdrawal. There's been great ambivalence about the troops, with some people very supportive and saying positive things, but many people feeling that the price has been far too high in terms of civilian casualties and in terms of also just displacement, because when people are fighting, it's very hard for normal life to go on. And these are largely agricultural areas where people, you know, would have been tilling their fields if there hadn't been fights between the Taliban and the U.S. and British forces.
Well, how much does the reported corruption of the Karzai regime and the Afghanistan government and society in general concern people there? And what role does that play in deciding what role the United States is going to have there in the future?
Well, I think it's an enormous issue here, and if anything, becoming more of one, because people really feel that a very small group has benefited during the Karzai administration, and that many people have not done very well, or certainly comparatively have done rather poorly. I mean, the country remains one of the poorest on the planet, despite some enormous wealth of people who've been in the Karzai government or are close to President Karzai or to his vice presidents. And I think a real question is whether there will be much support for the government once the Americans leave. It's already somewhat tarnished in some people's eyes by being so heavily supported by the Americans. Plus, it has many people in the government have not behaved in a way that Afghans find really acceptable in their leaders. And so once there is not, you know, once the bond of the American and international presence dwindles and the amount of money being spent here, which these people had the power to distribute, dwindles, it's very unclear to me how much support the government will have or whether it will really be very seriously weakened.
Will the Taliban look like a viable alternative to the Karzai government then at that point?
I think they will look like a viable alternative in some areas. They will not look like that in big cities, particularly in the north and in Kabul, which have modernized a lot. And there's great fear of a return to a period when girls weren't allowed to go to school and women had to wear burqas outside the house and people couldn't, you know, read what they wanted to read or listen to the radio or see television in the same, well, they could listen to the radio, but they couldn't watch television. So I think there's great fear of that in the cities. But I think in the countryside, there is, I was just spent some time in Helmand, and there's a feeling that the Taliban are less corrupt. And that could be a very powerful draw in places where there's not that much security.
Alyssa Rubin, again, Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times. We're going to take a very brief break later on Reporter's Notebook, movies, video games, and gun violence. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment on To the Point from PRI.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, President Karzai of Afghanistan has been in Washington for a couple of days at the Pentagon, at the State Department, and today at the White House with President Obama. And what they're talking about is the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan in 2014, at the end of 2014. How fast will that happen? And also, what happens after that? What will be the residual force? And will there be a zero option now being kicked around by the White House, or will there be more troops, 6,000 or 9,000 perhaps? in order to help accomplish the various missions that might be needed. Dexter Filkins is a veteran reporter who has been in Afghanistan for a great deal of time. He's written a book called The Forever War, based on his reporting in Iraq as well as Afghanistan. And he's now a writer for The New Yorker magazine. Dexter Filkins, good to have you on our program.
Hi.
You have said recently in The New Yorker, that what we have in Afghanistan is the definition of a quagmire. What do you mean by that?
I think what I meant was we can't really stay, and we can't really leave. We're just a little stuck, and I think what I mean by that is everybody wants to get out. We've been there for 12 years. We've spent $500 billion. We've lost, you know, hundreds of American citizens there, dead and wounded, and everybody wants to leave. If we couldn't have accomplished it in 12 years, how much more can we do? But I think the what's really, really troubling is when you go around the country, whether in the cities or the countryside, and you look at what we've built, and I mean the state, the Afghan state, the army, the government, it doesn't look very sturdy. And so you ask yourself the question, can this thing stand on its own when we leave? And it's hard to look into the future in that place, but all signs, at least to me, to my eyes, are pretty troubling. And so there you have it. We all want to leave, and we're all kind of terrified about what's going to happen if and when we do.
Can you elaborate a bit on what might happen? Obviously, as you indicate, you can't predict much there or anyplace else, but what's the worst-case scenario?
Well, I mean, just to get to the first part of your question about the future, I mean, there's a great example. When the Soviet Union, which invaded the country in 1979 and kind of destroyed the place, and, you know, it's one of the reasons why we ended up there, they left the country in 1989. They had trained an army, an Afghan army, and nobody gave it much, nobody imagined then that it was going to be able to fight and stand up on its own for very long. I think the Soviet leadership at the time gave it like 6 months or something. And they ended up fighting very well and hanging on, really until, I mean, first the Soviet Union collapsed, and then it still hung on for another year after that. And basically the money ran out, and that's when the army fell apart. So nobody expected that. So who knows, again. But I think the worst-case scenario is essentially like what happened after the Soviet Union left the country, and essentially what unfolded in the 1990s, which ultimately brought us, the United States, to that country in 2001. And that is a sort of a total collapse of the state, and a total collapse of order into a civil war with basically, you know, warlords with controlling their own fiefdoms around the country, big open spaces for all sorts of bad people to flow into. I think 200,000 people lost their lives at that point. And that's the problem here. It's everybody wants to leave, but this is what that kind of chaos is what sucked us into that country in 2001, and we all probably remember that. And so that to me is the nightmare scenario. If the state can't stand on its own and it collapses, what we get, and that's why it's so hard just to decide how many American troops should stay.
Of course, we originally went to try to capture Osama bin Laden and to get vengeance against September 11th. How was it that we ended up with the idea that we would somehow be responsible for maintaining a state?
Well, I mean, you know, we broke it. We bought it. I mean, the Al-Qaeda was there because the Taliban had basically conquered the country, or, you know, a good chunk of it in the 1990s. They allowed Al-Qaeda to operate there. So when we were attacked on 9/11, the United States decapitated the Taliban government. And that, I think, that obliged us to put something in its place. And that something, Hamid Karzai and his government, is essentially what
we put in place in beginning in 2010. We have tried to build a state there because we destroyed the state. It wasn't much, but we destroyed the state that existed at the time. And that's been the struggle, building something that will outlast our presence.
Dexter Filkins, and now with the New Yorker magazine. Let me go back to General David Barno, three-star, now retired, a former commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, 2003 to 2005. What we're hearing from Dexter Filkins is that when the Soviet Union collapsed and there was no more money, that's when the state of Afghanistan collapsed as well. Would we, if we adopted the zero option that the White House is apparently still considering, still provide a considerable amount of money in order to beef up the Afghan army, or do we still have a support in the United States for the kind of money that that might require?
I think that's one of the critical questions going forward. And I should make it clear that I do not endorse the zero option. I think it's a very risky option, and it's probably the least desirable scenario for the United States to go forward with. But it's still something that has to be seriously considered when we look at what kind of long-term support we're going to have here in the United States, with between popular support and between congressional support, especially for funding and for troops. So I think that's what's likely to occur if, for some reason, we ended up with an option with no American troops there, is that if we really did want to protect our interests in that part of the world, it would be very essential for us, along with a number of other international allies who've pledged to do this, to continue that funding support for the Afghan security forces in particular, and to continue at least some reasonably effective development inside the country of Afghanistan. I think that's a modest price to pay to continue to keep the state supported and moving forward after the 11 years of investment we've put in so far.
Would it be, do you think, an insult to those casualties that the United States has suffered if, in fact, we adopted the zero option?
I'm not sure I'd characterize it in that way, but I think that what the United States has to really look hard at as we look beyond 2014 is what are the vital interests that the United States has in this part of the world. And they're not just about Afghanistan. They're about a Pakistan next door that has over 100 nuclear weapons, and by mid-century will have 300 million Pakistanis and will be the largest Islamic state in the world. It has to look at Iran to the western flank, which is already attempting to grow its own nuclear weapons program and is very hostile to the United States. And it has to look at the other countries in the region that are looking for U.S. leadership and are looking for stability to continue to be able to keep their governments and their people moving forward. So I think we have some very significant strategic issues out there that we have to be very careful that as we go through this transition, we don't turn over that apple cart.
Let me go back to Alyssa Rubin, the Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times. Pakistan has been mentioned, as it always is, in this context. To what extent have relations with Pakistan and the United States improved recently, or have they improved? And what about the al-Qaeda and Taliban forces that are now camped out in that country?
Well, I think what's always very difficult with Pakistan is to separate what's being said from what's actually being done, and there has been a more reasonable sounding, affable sounding conversation and communications between Pakistan and the United States, and there has been some warming of relations in terms of allowing NATO troops again to move goods across the border to supply troops. But I think in terms of actually dealing with the al-Qaeda strongholds and the safe havens and the places where the Taliban are able to spend the winter and train and fundraise, there has really been no change that is visible here. I mean, there's a feeling that the safe havens are pretty much untouched. And so while Pakistan says it wants to help, it certainly is very worried about the Pakistani Taliban who are attacking Tariq-e-Taliban, who are attacking Pakistanis. Their commitment to actually getting rid of the Taliban seems quite weak. And so I'm not really sure that there has been any substantial change.
Back to Afghanistan itself. Once again, a moment ago, we heard the president talk about what he referred to as a different mission, training and advising and assisting Afghan forces. Dexter Filkins, back to you. What about the green on blue attacks, so-called, that we have seen fairly recently? How much do they complicate the mission that the president described?
Well, they make it really complicated. I mean, we're having a really hard time training Afghan soldiers and now to protect American soldiers from getting killed by the Afghan soldiers that we're training, we have to take all these precautions, and then the Afghans think that we don't trust them, and it's terrible. It's a terrible situation. It's a very effective way to kind of really throw sand in the gears.
General Barno, back to you, your take on that. That wasn't going on when you were the commander there.
No, it's actually a fairly new devilish incarnation here in the last 2 years. And it's extraordinarily debilitating. I mean, it fractures that trust that's essential, as Dexter noted. It causes Americans to maintain standoff between them and their Afghan partners when they're trying to work as advisors. And it really just undercuts the entire effort. It's very difficult to justify back here at home as well. I mean, Americans are, I think, cautiously tolerant of casualties taken in firefights with the Taliban, but they're not at all tolerant whatsoever of casualties, American casualties taken at the hands of the Afghan security forces. So it's a very, very dangerous trend.
And Alyssa Rubin, Dexter Filkins, who referred to the Civil War in the past. How would that work out in the future? Is the country still split between the North and the South? Is that the general geographical dynamic? And who's on which side?
Well, as Dexter said a few minutes ago, it's always very hard to predict the future here. And there are really so many divisions now that I'm not sure that the North-South dichotomy is the only important one. There's also, of course, many people who worked with the Karzai government, even in the South and the East, which are the Taliban and other insurgent strongholds. And it's not clear to me whether they will be able, if the Taliban were to regain influence and even power, would they be able to change sides and preserve their lives, or would they end up fighting? I think you could see some more localized fighting as well. And I do think that in provinces that are mixed, where you have significant Pashtun populations, but also some of the other ethnic groups, that those are going to be very vulnerable. So when up in the north, where it's pretty much all Tajik and Uzbek, you probably see a fairly peaceful environment. But I think it would be a localized fight in places where people are trying to gain the upper hand in provinces, for instance. I don't know that you'd see the kind of total civil war again. I don't quite see that scenario. I can imagine Kabul holding intact, but the rest of the country becoming quite chaotic. So you couldn't really move much beyond Kabul.
Dexter Filkins, a final question to you. Again, based on your reporting in both Afghanistan and Iraq, your book is called The Forever War. You said earlier with regard to Afghanistan, we can't stay and we can't leave either. How does it fit into the idea of a forever war?
Well, I think we are leaving. And I think it's clear to me, at least, I think by President Obama's tone, body language, the way he talks. He's been, everything he has said in the last couple of months, and particularly, I think, over the course of the presidential campaign when Afghanistan hardly came up at all, everything he's done and said has indicated that he wants less of a commitment than a greater one. And so I don't think the zero option is all that likely, but I think the numbers are probably going to be pretty low, and I think what, you know, of American soldiers who stay behind and train Afghan forces, and I think what's really, really tricky there is just unless you have a really high number, I mean, a substantial number, over 5,000 or 10,000, you can't do that much. And if you can't do that much, then what are they doing there? And that's the trick. I mean, I think it's really hard, and I think the challenge is going to be for President Obama is, he wants to bring the troops home. But if you kind of nickels and dimes this thing, I think there's going to be trouble ahead.
Okay, pretty grim assessments from everybody on our program. But thank you all very much for being with us. Dexter Filkins, again, with The New Yorker magazine, author of The Forever War, based on reporting in Iraq and Afghanistan. Alyssa Rubin, the Kabul bureau chief now for The New York Times. General David Barno, three-star retired former commander in Afghanistan. And James Kitfield, our earlier guest, senior correspondent for The National Journal. Good to have all of you on our program, and thank you very much for joining us. As part of preparing recommendations for reducing gun violence, Vice President Biden met last night with executives of the film industry and today with the makers and promoters of video games. We'll hear more about that in a moment on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Vice President Biden has said that he's most likely to focus on background checks and the type of weapons that Americans are allowed to own, as well as high-capacity magazines. The NRA, of course, insists that exposure to violence in films and video games is the real cause of the deadly incidents that we have seen so recently, including, of course, the one in Connecticut. Ted Johnson covers the intersection of politics and entertainment for the trade magazine Variety and its political website, Wilshire and Washington. Ted Johnson, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So the vice president met last night with the Hollywood people and today with the makers and marketers and users of video games. What has he said about it, and what do we know about those meetings?
Well, last night's meeting, we don't know a whole lot about it. The industry has been quite silent on the details, and the vice president hasn't said, we're going to do this or they agreed to this. But what has gotten out there, it really does seem to me that what was discussed was the industry said we have these voluntary rating systems that have been in place for quite some time, and that perhaps there could be some enhancements to those rating systems. They put out a joint statement. A number of these trade organizations from the industry put out a joint statement that said we're willing to take a look at those rating systems. They have been adamant, though, that they do not want to see any government intervention that would have to do with content. And to be frank, given court decisions, there probably isn't much that the government can actually do when it comes to regulating violence on screen.
We do have, obviously, the First Amendment. They have, I guess, also said in that statement that you referred to that, and of course, this is, the reason for the rating systems, that parents ought to have every opportunity to shield their children from violence in the film.
Yes, and but one of the things that parents' organizations point out right now is it's one thing to have these rating systems for movies, TV shows, music even, but they can't really be shielded from the marketing. You go around the streets of Los Angeles and you see a big billboard, actually for Arnold Schwarzenegger's next movie, and he's holding this huge Gatling gun. And it's that type of marketing that some organizations, one is called Common Sense Media, has really focused in on in the wake of the Newtown tragedy. And they think that there is a role for government to perhaps put in some measures that would actually limit the type of advertising that can be done in certain times of the day, and even some of the advertising that is done in movie theaters.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, former governor of the state of California, now posing with a Gatling gun on billboards around the state. Here's an interesting portion of an interview with Quentin Tarantino, who, of course, has directed some very violent movies. It was conducted by Britain's Channel 4 News with Krishna Guru Murthy just a couple of days ago. Here's the way it went.
The vice president is talking to people in the movie industry today about violence in response to
And you know
the,
where I stand on to, it.
Which is that there's no relationship.
And yes.
But you haven't said why you think there's no relationship.
It's none of your damn business what I think about that.
Well, it's my job to ask you why you think
and
that.
And I'm saying
very influential.
No.
Ted Johnson, back to you. Not very good public relations, I would think, on the part of Quentin Tarantino, if there is concern about this.
Yes, he has. I mean, he's right. He has been asked over and over again about a number of his movies that have really pushed the envelope on violence. The industry is actually in somewhat of a pickle here because you do have so many people within the entertainment community who are in favor of gun control and gun control measures, and yet you do have many of them who perform, who write, who direct some of these very violent movies. And in fact, one gun rights advocate put out a video last week that it collected some of the pro gun control statements of a number of celebrities, and then interplayed them with some very violent movies that are out there. Now, Tarantino is going to argue definitely that, hey, his movies are rated R. They are not made for a very young audience. And he has already responded to these questions. Parents' organizations, however, do feel that there is no kind of sense of responsibility for some of the content that is actually put out there, and again, particularly when it comes to marketing.
Let's talk a bit about the video game industry. Here is a segment of the Wayne LaPierre, who is the executive vice president of the NRA, and the speech that he made just a few weeks ago.
There exists in this country, sadly, a callous, corrupt, and corrupting shadow industry that sells and stows violence against its own people. Through vicious, violent video games.
And here's the way some of those video games sound. That's a bit of the game Call of Duty Black Ops 2, one of the games cited today by Andrew Martin as in the New York Times in an article entitled The Real and Virtual Firearms Nurture, a Marketing Link. Andrew Martin, good to have you on our program.
It's good to be here.
Tell us how this relates to the subject we're talking about, and is there product placement going on?
Well, you mentioned Call of Duty, and if you've played Call of Duty and some of its competitors, the fact is they use real guns in the game, branded weapons, and players get to choose, you know, whether they use a Glock or a Remington or an assault rifle or a pistol. The video game makers, in order to use those brands, have to obtain licenses from the gun makers themselves. So, I mean, the fact is that there is this very mutually beneficial relationship between gun manufacturers and video game makers, because the video game makers get to present realistic weapons and the gun makers get this incredible publicity.
What do the video game makers and marketers have to say about whether there is, in fact, any real connection between their product with the placement of branded weapons and the violence that we are so, as a nation, eager to curtail?
Well, I have to tell you that in the last month, they've said zero. They're answering almost no calls, and they don't want to go near this thing. But, you know, in the past, they have made the case, as have many filmmakers, that there is no connection between violent video games and actual violence. And there is, in fact, some studies to back up that point, although it's a very controversial point. But there are many academic studies to back up that point.
Ian Bogost has written, he's involved in the video game as a magazine editor, I believe, has written in the Atlantic magazine that the video game industry really fell into a trap when it even agreed to go and talk to the vice president, because the moment you say you ought to be part of the conversation, then you're taking the attention away from all the possible all of the positive things that video games do in schools and elsewhere. Are they using that as an argument?
I haven't heard that argument. Although the one point I'll make is, I will be amazed if they agree to much of anything. I mean, Call of Duty, the last version of Call of Duty, opened with a bigger first weekend than Avatar. I mean, these are huge money making. Entertainment more so than the most popular movies. So, and you know, we're talking about the most violent video games. So, I can't imagine under any circumstances that they are going to be willing to change that, because they're extremely popular.
Okay, so they are talking to the vice president, both the video game people and the Hollywood people. We don't know exactly what's going to come out of that. We do know that he is expected to present his recommendations to the president very soon. We will see what happens then. There are, of course, others, parents and doctor groups and others, who believe that these cultural products do, in fact, have a negative influence. Thanks to Andrew Martin with the New York Times, Ted Johnson with the Variety, and Wilshire and Washington.com. Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Evan George, Anna Scott, Caitlin Schamberg, Technical Director Mike Newport, Managing Producer Sonia Geis. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.